and we'll have to review tomorrow.
Speech and allegation.
Yes, that's where I was.
Speech and allegation. You thought I didn't know what I was going
to do. I was down Tampa speaking last night, the end of a wee hour or something, the entire day.
This was Eliezer's speech today, when Josephus said. Now, I want to talk about the nature of these speeches in the ancient world, ancient literature. Since we long ago, my generous friends, resolved never to be servants to the Romans, these extreme zealots, the Sicarii, long ago we decided we were never going to serve the Romans, so we've been killing them wholesale. Or to any other than to God himself, who alone is the true and just Lord of mankind, the time is now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice. Sounds like Patrick Henry, doesn't it? The time, long ago we decided that we were going to serve God, not the Romans. Now is the time to put that decision into action. And let us not at this time bring a reproach upon ourselves for self-contradiction, while we formerly would not undergo slavery, though it were then without danger, but now must now, together with slavery, choose such punishments also as are intolerable. I pointed out they could look over the side and see their countrymen working themselves to death building the ramp. Well, anyway, it goes on, and I'll take time to read the speech, but it's a great speech. It's in Wars of the Jews, Book 7, 6, if you want to read it sometime in the future. Speech of Eliezer ben Yair, his name, Y, Ben, son of, in Aramaic, Yair, Y-A-I-R. And so, Josephus finishes this great speech, let our wives die before they are abused. And our children before they have tasted of slavery. Let our kids see death before they become slaves. After we have slain them, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon another mutually and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument for us. But first, let us destroy our money and the fortress by fire, for I am well assured that this will be a great grief to the Romans. Burn it. Don't give them anything to... don't give them any money to spend or buildings to inherit. And by the way, they did this, the last one alive. Set fire to everything. And let us spare nothing. This is very interesting. Listen to this. And let us spare nothing but our provisions, our food. Not destroy the food. Why? For they, that is the food, will be a testimonial when we are dead that we were not subdued for one of necessaries, but that according to our original resolution we have preferred death before slavery. Leave the food, so that they'll know that we weren't starved out. The presence of the food will underscore the fact that this was a voluntary act. We were not driven to it. That we had a choice between slavery and death, and we chose death. This was Eliezer's speech. Well, anyway, there was some quibbling, some that wouldn't go along with it. And so he again says... he spurred them on, saying, I guess I overestimated you. I thought you really, everybody really felt the way I did. And they finally agree. And so the suicide pact is made. Now, as Eliezer was proceeding on this exhortation, they all cut him off short and made haste to do the work as full of an unconquerable ardor of mind and moved with a demoniacal fury. That is, even before he finished speaking, they set to the work of this, of carrying out the suicide pact. So they went their ways, as one still endeavoring to be before another. And as thinking that this eagerness would be a demonstration of their courage and of good conduct, some of them wanted to be the first to kill themselves and their family, so that they would demonstrate themselves courageous to others and be encouragement, not be the last. So great was the zeal that they were in to slay their wives and children and themselves also. Nor indeed when they came to the work itself, that is to actually doing it, did their courage fail them as one might imagine it would have done. But they then held fast the same resolution without wavering, which they had upon hearing of Eliezer's speech. God, yet every one of them still retained the natural passion of love to themselves and their families. Josephus points out that these people were not monsters. It was because they loved their families, the children, they were not going to let them go into slavery yet.
What did the law say about killing themselves?
It was against the law, Moses. Well, because the reasoning they went upon appeared to them to be very just. That is, it was better for, I would rather put my own son to death, for instance, than see him become a slave. Not just, it wouldn't become household slaves. These Jews, it would not be a kind slavery, it would be a cruel slavery. Would they kill my wife and see her abused by the soldiers? The husbands tenderly embraced their wives and took their children into their arms and gave the longest parting kisses to them with tears in their eyes. And at the same time, they didn't complete what they had resolved on as if they had been executed by the hands of strangers. They had nothing else for their comfort but the necessity that they were in of doing this execution. To avoid that prospect they had of the miseries they were to suffer from their enemies. Embrace the children, kiss them, and execute them. Or was there any length any one of these men found that scrupled to act their part in this terrible execution? But every one of them dispatched his dearest relations. Isn't it something? They gave men the responsibilities to kill their own children and their own wives. Miserable men indeed were they, whose distress forced them to slay their own wives and children with their own hands as the lightest of those evils that were before them. That is, that was the best choice. So they, not being able to bear the grief they were under for what they had done any longer, and esteeming it an injury to those they had slain, to live even the shortest space of time after them, they presently laid all they had in the heap and set fire to it. Then they chose 10 men by lot. And now they did this quickly. After a man had killed his wife and his children, if he had children, all of them didn't have children, of course, and all of them didn't have wives, but those that did this quickly, and then they were ready to die themselves. They wouldn't want to live because of the regret, well, the remorse, the terror of what they had done. So then they chose 10 men by lot out of them to slay all the rest, every one of whom laid himself down by his wife children on the ground, and threw his arms about them, and often they offered their necks to the stroke of those who by lot executed that melancholy office. Now by lot they would draw, put the names on an ostracon, broken pieces of pottery, and draw. What they did, they put all the men were left, their families had been killed, they drew lots, and 10 men were picked out to execute all the other men, these men would lie down with their families, embrace them, so that they themselves would kill, and offered their necks to the stroke of those who by lot executed that melancholy office. When these 10 had without fear slain them all, they made the same move of casting lots for themselves as they drew again. All the men drew and got 10. Then the 10 drew and got 1. Well, it worked like this. Made the same move of casting lots for themselves, that he whose lot it was should first kill the other 9, and after all should kill himself. According to all those, had courage sufficient to be in no way behind one another. Behind one another in doing or suffering. So for conclusion, the 9 offered their necks to the executioner, and he who was the last of all took a view of all the other bodies, lest perchance some or other among so many that were slain should want his assistance to be quite dispatched. That is, very few went around, there were over 900 of them. You can picture John, remember the pictures of Jonestown? It's about that number. But he went around and checked all the bodies to make sure everyone was dead, that someone was not suffering. And so when he'd done this, he perceived that they were all slain. He set fire to the palace, and with great force of his hand, ran his sword entirely through himself, and fell down dead near his own relations. So these people died with this intention, that they would not have so much as one soul among them all alive to be subject to the Romans. Yet there was an ancient woman, and another who was of akin to Eleazar, and superior to most women in prudence and learning, with 5 children, who had concealed themselves in caverns underground. They carried water, these caverns were the underground water system. Now these caverns, and carried water thither for to drink, and were hidden there when the rest were intent upon the slaughter of one another. These others were 960 in number, the women and children being withal included in that computation. So anyway, so these 2 women took 5 children, and they hid, and came out and told the story. Now,
So that was the fall of the cell. The Romans came in, and they expected to have to fight their way in at great cost. Lo and behold, they found that the only important standing building was the palace. The palace was set on fire, and everything destroyed except food. And there's a great, and the Romans were very much angry at this, because here many of them had lost friends. They had spent a miserable year trying to, you know, build this ramp, trying to get in there. You know, and finally the day was going to come, and they were going to really give it to these Jews. And they get up the next morning, and they battered away through the last part of the wall, standing firm through the wall. What did they find? Two women, five children.
Did they find the, were they found, the two women and the...
Yes, but in fact, Prince Josephus tells it that the Romans were afraid to go in. They got quiet. They kept, you know, waiting to, they penetrated this gap. They would go up the ramp, behind the tower, was on top of the ramp, and roll over through these two walls. And they were afraid to go in. They didn't know what was going on. They thought it was a trap. And the women hollered at them and told them, nobody here, fine.
Did they execute the woman?
We don't know. Let's see. It doesn't say. It says this, the Romans could not take vengeance. They so met with the multitude of the slain. As in the palace, see what they did, they killed themselves in the palace, one of Herod's palaces, and Eleazar set fire to it. I mean, the last, not Eleazar, the last one, whoever it was, and so they killed himself and then set fire, or set fire to the building and then killed himself. So when they tried to put out the fire, it's all wood burners, it was stone, and they found these bodies. Well, so in a way, it's not like the American. By the way, Masada has become, for the modern state of Israel, what the Alamo is to America. By the way, the story of the Alamo, you ever read there, ever visit the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas? That is, I recommend it. Don't go in the summertime. Florida is like a refrigerator compared to San Antonio, Texas in July. But if you get a chance to see the Alamo, read that story. That was these men who voluntarily gave up their lives. They didn't kill themselves, but what they did was they were holding off delaying Santana's army to give Sam Houston time to build a sufficient force. And they knew, David Crockett, Tennessee volunteer, they knew what they got to do. Like something funny? Yeah, he played it in the movie. He played it. And that's kind of an idealized section. It was an idealized, but that movie did all this night. It was Hollywood. That movie did, I've been to the Alamo and read the story, and that movie did capture the spirit of the Alamo. I thought it was the most stirring, did you see that movie, the Alamo? I thought one of the most stirring scenes I've ever seen in motion pictures. Who wrote that? Very perceptible. Which did catch the spirit. Remember the blind woman? And all the men, they were sending women and children out. And this blind woman's husband, the feather in his hat, he was going to stay, send his wife out with the rest of it. But she was blind, and there was nobody to take care of her. And he was torn between the two. He wanted to stay and do his part, die with his friends, and yet his wife. And she was blind, and who would take care of her? And finally came to the end, and he couldn't stand it any longer. He said, "Fellas, you know how it is." He said, "You know I'm not a coward. Not stay, but I just can't let her go." The men all understood, you know. And then she spoke up and she said, "I may be blind, but I'm just as good as any woman in Texas. And I've got a right to get up my man, just like the rest of them."
Yeah.
And they say, "Great courage, the woman. I'm just as good as anybody else. They can give up their husband, I can give up mine, even though I'm blind." Well, that's a great moment, you know. Great. Well, a Masada, the state of modern state of Israel has a coin. One of the, I don't know if it's the slogan, but it's one of the slogans. the modern state of Israel is Masada will never fall again. One of the reasons that the state of Israel, modern state of Israel, has been able to hold out against real odds is the spirit of Masada and Israeli military units. I don't know if all of them are, but some of them are. When they're sworn in, they take them by helicopter to the top of Masada, and there they take the oath. Thousands of Israeli soldiers have been taken to Masada. They stand on that ground. The Israeli age have been here year 960, and they take the oath. When they say Masada will never fall again, what they mean is that Israel, we may die, we may live, but if Israel falls, it'll be because we're all dead. And the story of Masada has become a great encouragement to the modern state of Israel.
Have they made a movie out of it?
Pardon?
Have they made a movie out of it?
I don't know. By the way, this leading excavator of Masada is Yigal Yadin, and this is a, and he's written this completely big picture history of it. Let me show you some of these. You know, some of you, you guys don't look up here, maybe you can see a little bit better. You want to move up?
There's a real good fictional account of that. I think it was Frank Slaughter.
Probably so. I wanted to show you. I'm sure I didn't mark. Here it is. Here's a picture of these modern detached the military units on the top of Masada taking the oath. Can you see this at all? You can't see it, but these are, this is the top of Masada. These are units that are taking the oath. This is the coin. We shall remember free men. Like, remember the Alamo? It's got a picture of Masada on it. On one side of the coin it says, we shall remain free men. Remember what Eliezer said? It's taken from the speech I just read. We're going to remain free. How? By dying. We shall remain free men. It's got a picture of Masada. And on the back it says, Masada shall not fall again. And it says the mother. It's the special medal, not the coin, it's a special medal struck by the Israeli government.
Just the sort of national.
This is the coin. This is the front back of the coin. Remember the coin says, we shall remain free man, next sir, from the speech of Eliezer. It's a medallion. It's not a coin, it's a medallion. Y'all see this? Anyway, this is the coin. This shows men being sworn in. Well, anyway, I want to show you the picture. It's kind of hard because it's spread out. But this is a picture. You saw it in recall Dr. Henderson's slide. This is a picture of Masada. It's like a large ship-like shaped mesa. And you can see why it would be such a natural fortress. You see that? Yes. Yeah, it's better. You can see a little further off. See that? And if you look closely off this picture, you can see that's the picture. See that? And on the back, on this picture, if you look closely, you can see the outline of Silva's camps. Stand, look. These square things are the outline of the different sections of Flavius Silva's camps. You just down the top and look down and see them. Yes.
Is the ramp still there?
Yes. The ramp. Here's the ramp right in the middle. So let's see. No, on this. It's not on this side. Yeah. You look here. This is the ramp right here. And you can still walk up the ramp yourself. In this picture, the ramp is right here, this angle. Just the picture there. No, it did go on the top. And it's worn off since then. But it never did go all the way to the top.
Well, they didn't have helicopters then. The only trail up was that serpentine trail.
Two trails up, but yeah.
How did the people get up there? Did they have another? They walked up, even little kids walked up that serpentine trail. Brought up all their food and everything. Brought up all their food and everything.
They did not
leave
the site, did they?
No. Well, some was on wood.
The raiders.
Did they have a secret way to get out where they sneak out and get the food or
no.
something?
One way, yeah. They,
Also, they would bring up there, you see the cisterns, there was lower cisterns, upper cisterns. And the cistern, the lower cistern would catch water. They were designed so that when a rainstorm came, it would just cap it, and then the water would be carried up by slaves or servants or anybody who carried over at various times. The water would be carried from the lower cisterns to the upper cisterns in time of war, so that they knew that they were going to have to defend it. They would simply carry water up from the lower cisterns to the upper cisterns, so they had water to hold out. This shows a picture from the top of the side. These square depressions are Silva's camp. You see the one on the sky back there, that makes me think of it. This is not the best. This is a picture of the one of the lower cisterns. The sun shining in. Dr. Henderson had a picture, shows the wall, plaster wall, if you recall. Shows the man standing, and it shows how big they were. This is a picture of the ramp. It's a dirt ramp.
Is the wall still, there isn't any wall on the top now, is
it? See, someplace you can see the remains of where it was, yes.
Talking about building that ramp up like that, when I was in Japan in 55, I was walking through the countryside, and at that time they were still building roads that way. So people would have their litters, a basket on either side, and they'd build up litters, and then...
Like I said, the slaves, they would have a basket either side, and they would dig it out, load them up, some would load them up, and carry it up and dump it, walk back down, carry it up and dump it. Imagine how many loads we took.
The world's biggest bulldozer.
This is some of the food that they found. Walnuts, different grains, still edible.
How were they preserved in mind?
Dates, walnuts, olive stones, salt grain, and pomegranates. No? Oh, some of them were. It's the dry climate. Some of them in best food.
Dry
places. That, yes.
Did they grow anything on top of them?
These presents are armor plates. What they would do in the ancient world, they would, you can see these, the way they would make armor is that obviously you couldn't make one piece of steel to hang on your chest, it didn't work very well. Sometimes the ancient Greek warriors would, but they tended to die a lot. In medieval times they did it. For instance, in the late 14th century, 15th century, well, especially 13th century, any knight going into battle had at least four or five pages with him. And one of their main jobs would be to get him back on his feet if he got knocked down. So what they would do is, they'd take metal and they would overlay it. It would be tied at the top, and then like a shingle roof, so that it would be a form of shield, but yet it could be flexible. It would be sewn onto a leather garment. And they found several of these Jews. It is the most interesting thing. Here is still the plaited hair from some of the women who died on the Masada. And this is some sandals that were found in a few minutes. I'll show you the picture where they were in situ that is found. Well, they kind of here they are photographed. Here are some of the weapons. This one arrow still had the wooden shaft on it. They're all these here. So these are arrows, sandals, and hair from some of the women who were. You see that? Can y'all get that close enough? How do you see that?
This is the braids of hair.
How did the hair get plated silver? How was the hair silver plated?
No, plated.
Oh,
that means
braided.
Braided, I'm sorry. Yeah. Most of them, we don't know them. Some of them, they're probably, the bodies were dealt with in various ways, nobody knows. Some of them, I'll show you some of them.
I figured some of them might still be there, you know.
Oh, they are. Here's some. Now, you don't have to be too close on these. This is some of the beautiful mosaics on the floor of the chapel. Some of the buildings are up there. Beautiful work. Herod, imagine building something as elaborate and beautiful as that. It's a great place when Herod built it. And this shows them excavating, digging away, getting down to the floor of the mosaic. This is a better picture. You see the mosaic?
What are the mosaics? How were they made?
Inlaid stone and painted stone. Tiling, yes. Stone tiling. Yeah, here's another example. This is the inside of the building, floor. Probably elaborate.
Yeah, let me show pictures. It's quite elaborate work. Here's somebody, the splinter that was there. Now here's, they found a basket. Palm frond basket, still in a marvelous state of preservation. Way back to that time. Here's some ivory, obviously. This is a very important picture. This is a picture of the remains of the oldest synagogue ever found. The only pre-Christian synagogue ever excavated is on the Masada. Only one back before the time of Christ. Show the stone pillars. And they found a scroll of Ezekiel. My notice, scroll of Ezekiel there. And it's interesting. The scroll of Ezekiel is almost word for word. It corresponds almost word for word to the Masoretic text that we use. It became the antiquity of it. Very important find. But from what it's found, it's very important to it was found in connection with the synagogue. Here are some of the ostracod that the men used, put their names on. First the 10, you know, just everybody, all the men put their name on, then selected 10 and the 10, selected the 1. Now they've been inked in. You can read so you can see the Hebrew. Some of the names are Yehohanan, which is what? John. Yehuda, which is Judah. Shimeon, Simon. Here are some of the bodies. You asked about the bodies of the skeletons. Now these were found in a cave, one of the sections where apparently some went to, either they were thrown there or they went there to die. One of the upper caves to show skeletons. This is very interesting. This ostracod is the ostracod Ben Yair, the one who gave the speech and we shall remain free men. This is the ostracod with his name on it. We don't know who the last one was, but Ben Yair. So isn't it interesting to find, read his speech in Josephus and then find the very ostracod on which his name was placed. You know what ostracod means, don't you? It's a broken piece of broken shard, a piece of pottery. We got a word ostracized from it. Well, you need to ostracize somebody. The ancient Greeks, back in the late classical period, one of the great Greek leaders. You all know this guy? Greek leaders. Themistocles built the great Athenian navy, built the navy which became basically the Athenian Empire. He realized that every time that there was in the Greek so-called democracy, there was a real problem. And when people became dissatisfied, because when a man became powerful, he tended to try to become king. So the way to keep an unpopular man from getting too much power is they would vote, all the citizens would vote. And they had to have 6,000 votes whether or not they're going to have an ostracism. If 6,000 said yes, then the men, and just don't take, you know, how they took that. Then these citizens would come and they would put the name of the man that they wanted to ostracize on a piece of an ostracod. Hence that's where the term came from. Put his name. And the man who got the most votes had to leave Athens for 10 years in honorable exile, that he was not run out of town to rail. Didn't lose his money or his civil rights or anything. He just had to leave, live somewhere else for 10 years. And this, you know, saved his life, and get that way, if you got a powerful leader that the city wouldn't get rid of, they could get rid of without a revolution, without a fight. So the Minister of himself ostracized some years later. There's one famous Greek who, I can't recall how famous he was. He was one of the candidates for ostracism that year, and the story is told that some poor farmer came along and said to him, he didn't know who he was, he's asking someone, he told him to write his name, not knowing who it was, on his ostracod, because he didn't know he could write. And he said, well, why do you want to, it's his own name, he said, well, why do you want to ostracize him? Meaning himself. He said, well, because he's getting too proud. Maybe he is, people. The guy doesn't know the difference, but he wrote his own name on it. It was ostracized. So anyway, did y'all know that? That's the term ostracized comes from. This is the very ostracod of Ben Yair. I think that's remarkable, isn't it? Yes.
What did they, after they wrote their name on it, they turned it over to the
Well, this is going to have a hat. I'm faster. Okay. Nobody. Ready for you today. Okay. Now, the Jewish, this was 1873 in the Sodom Bell. And the Jewish state had one more death row in 132 B.C., and I'll just mention this in passing. In 132 B.C., the last Jewish revolt took place. The Jewish revolted one more time. 132 B.C., yes.
You mean A.D. or B.C.?
A.D., I don't want to say that.
A.D. 130.
And it was the revolt under Bar Kokhba. Or commonly called Bar Kokhba. Son of the Star, Kokhav is the Hebrew. Kokhav. The Hebrew word for star. Son of the Star. That's a nickname. Kind of like Judas Maccabeus, the hammer. In 132 B.C., he led a revolt against the Romans, which was put down. And that was the last death. It was quite a notable revolt. He killed a lot of people, killed about as many Jews as he did Romans. But, and time for me to go into this, but with the revolt of the Jewish state was, for all practical purposes, destroyed in A.D. 70. Masada was a mopping up action.
That was 73, right?
Yes. In other words, you got that? Masada was a major battle, but it was not critical to the movement of historical events. That is, what the Romans were kind of monomaniacs. What forced them to go to tremendous time and expense to... Well, what difference did it make to have 960 people up there on a hill? All they had to do was take a Roman garrison, or maybe two or three Roman garrisons, build a wall and starve them to death. That time built a wall. They built the wall anyway, around the bottom. Why build a ramp? They was eventually starved them out. Eventually eating up all the food.
Probably a lesson to other.
Yeah, they would. The whole point was you had to teach them a lesson. Honeystone. But you see, the main thing is this tremendous military expedition to get these people off of that hill. And, the tremendous event that it was really was not historically important at all. The fall of Jerusalem, that was historically important. That changed things. The 960 Jews, men, women, and children, they killed four times that many when they took the city of Jerusalem. What difference did it make? Well, it made some difference. But what I want to see is it was a mopping up action. Later on, the Jews tried one more time under Bar Kokhba, and he was put down. It's interesting that his last holdout was in a cave. I can't recall right now. I've
got my notes and he's ready to go look it up. He would remember anyway.
So, but interesting, the cave, which was the headquarters of Bar Kokhba, last Jewish revolutionary, has been discovered. Interestingly enough, it's just like a kind of sidelight to Masada, was the oldest synagogue ever found. An interesting bit of serendipity to the discovery of the cave of Bar Kokhba was that the oldest Roman toga has been found. The oldest existing Roman toga, which is of great interest to ancient historians, of no interest whatever to most people. the letters of Bar Kokhba have been found, several letters which he himself wrote. This cave was such a good fortress that the only way to get to it is by a helicopter and a rope ladder. It's inaccessible from the bottom. So they get to it by flying a helicopter over the thing and dropping a ladder down and climbing down the ladder.
How did he get to it?
Helicopter.
Probably
by rope ladders of some kind, either from the top or from the bottom, or you know, from there on down. Rope ladders, very big. Probably had elaborate rope ladders to go down, and they could pull up, come up, pull them up behind them.
Put the first push in, the rope ladder up there.
Yeah. So, he shaved down to the top somewhere.
I don't know. Why didn't you ask those questions?
Yeah.
Okay, now let me say one more word, and in the 5 minutes we got left about the destruction of the Jewish state, this is the last lecture we'll have in this course. And that is, the destruction of the Jewish state changed many things, some of which I've already suggested. Number one, it changed the relationship between the Jews and the church. In what way? Review. In what way? Changed the relationship between the Jews and the Jewish Christians and the non-Christian Jews. When the Christians set out the Jewish war, the Jews never forgave us. It was important theologically because it was the end of temple worship. Remember, the Sadducees dominated the aristocratic Jewish worship and dominated the temple system. Well, pretty hard to have a system that revolves around the temple if you don't have a temple. And so the Sadducees evaporated. That was the end of the Sadducees. It's interesting that because the Pharisees had a decentralized emphasis in their religion, the Pharisees became the dominant sect, more than ever, of Judaism. It was Pharisaic Judaism that was carried on the tradition after the destruction of the Jewish state. It's very important. And always the theme was next year in Jerusalem. Eventually it was made illegal for a Jew to live in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was downtrodden to the Gentiles, as Jesus said. That is, from this period of revolutions until modern times, the Jews did not live in Jerusalem. Later it became a Roman colony, then it became a Muslim city for many years, and then the crusades were an attempt by some of the crusades to liberate Jerusalem against the dead. These were Christians, not Jews, Europeans, and until modern times, so Jerusalem. The Jews once again live in Jerusalem. Any questions, comments? Interesting to you? This came at very close. Now, when I teach the early Christian history, I start with about 80, 70, we'll go on. That period, move on from there. So only in that class. Well, that's what we'll take from here on. So the altars of the destruction of Masada was really the end of the Jewish state. Well, if you have no more questions, go. The test is the second hour. So, there is a statement you will be asked to say a yes or no if you finish the reading. We'll have your grade. I'll suggest something to you. Shouldn't do this. I'm going to. I've always been a nice guy. Watch out now. You've got, say, 100. If you've only got 20 or 30 pages or 10 or 15 pages to go to finish your reading, I suggest you finish it. Up your grade. If you've got 100 pages to go, I suggest you take your lumps on that one and spend your time studying for the exam. Understand? I think you would have your grade, or your final grade, more than do well in the exam rather than fail to review your reading.
That reading going on the grade of the final exam or the final grade of the final exam?
I will do this. I will compute your final grade, and then I will amend it if necessary in terms of just the reading assignment. But
all of their state. Not necessarily in this order. Well, I'm usually out of order, but because the fall of Jewish state, including the all aspects of the Jewish revolt, beginning in Galilee, the fall of Jerusalem, fall of Masada, founded also the Bar Kokhba, founded 132 AD. We'll cover Paul and the cities of Paul's evangelism. We talked about Ephesus, Corinth, Antioch, Estia, which was near Corinth, the Eastern Games. Take in the emperors, the Herods, various discussions we had as touching archaeology. Again, the subject of the cross, the crucifixion of the cross. Take you always through the discussion about Jerusalem versus Jewish versus Gentile Christianity.
She told me.
Jewish versus Gentile Christianity. Any questions? Anything in your notes you might get a question about that, I guess, as far as subject matter. I'm not limiting myself if I'm able to mention something here. I'll cover everything from where in our term, from where the last exam left off. We began in our discussion in this half, began with the emperors, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the record I have. So we began this half with the emperors. So that's where the test will begin. You were talking about everything up to what we had there. Okay. Now, let me ask you this, is there any any questions now about what it's going to cover? You know what it's going to cover, what kind of test it's going to be?
When you said the emperors, is that going to include the emperors after the fall of Jerusalem or just the ones before?
The only ones we discussed.
Okay.
Tiberius and Nero. Okay, any other questions? Is there anything unclear in your notes that you think might be important but you don't know like you've written? Or your notes don't reflect what I said.
Yeah, some of the names you wrote about the archaeologists,
yeah. Didn't spell them or anything like that. Right. Let's see. Well, I put some of the word in there. Yeah. Somebody listen to one of your notes. What was I going for? I'm in Kenyon, Petrie.
Robinson, there's coffee.
I emphasize the questions that I have in archaeology will be only on those things I emphasize from class, so there will not be some minor name that I drop in the course of the discussion. I did not. Anything I have on the field of archaeology, I believe I'm correct about this. Okay. I emphasize in class. Again, as I said before, the bulk of the test will be things I emphasize in class, but I do feel that they're the right. But that's an emphasized question for the reason that I'm here.
Pietro
della Valle. He was the 17th century traveler who had a tourist interest in Palestine and wrote a book. And first, what you might call outsider scientific interest, first outside interest in Palestine as the place of this land of the Bible. Mm-hmm. I guess. Any other particular questions that you've got to your notes?
I'll
say Peter. You discuss. Okay. Put this somewhat in order. You recall that we talked about the emperors. What does that do with that? First of all, I talked about the development of Palestinian archaeology.
now that the earlier survey work done by Robinson, but that there was no really scientific work done until Petrie, because he established the chronology of the older chronology, the basis for dating, and based on what? Here's one of the ideas of
pottery
dating. And then we talk about the Kenyon-Wheeler method, and they were asking Kenyon to solve the problem of anachronisms because of artifacts in the hole in the depression set up by the removal of walls. Ed, do you have any questions or any, I think your mind's pretty clear on the development of Palestinian archaeology? Okay, the emperors that we discussed were, well, remember you got your sheet that shows the chronology. We talked about Tiberius, who was adopted son of Augustus. The last part of his reign was known for his terrible purges, his terrible sexual perversions. He was followed by Caligula, who apparently went mad later in his reign. Caligula was assassinated by the Praetorian Guard, recall. And Caligula, Emperor, was a good friend of who? What's your great friend?
First,
we called it instead the Golden Chain. And Agrippa, he allowed Agrippa to maintain, to regain the part of the Herodian family, that's the territory ruled by Herod the Great. Following Caligula, we had who?
Claudius.
And his mother gave up on him, but he became to be a fairly good emperor. He had woman trouble. First wife, Messalina. He had her put to death, and he married some fine kind of fire, married Agrippina, mother of who?
Yeah.
And wanted she do after she had gotten the book of him, and probably as well as the successor. Poison. And Nero, during his first 5 years, the golden years, he was pretty good, but then he was cruel, not crazy, but certainly cruel. And Nero was on false to it, which always to the worst court. Nero blamed the Christians for the burning of Rome, and this was the pretext for persecuting Christians. Yeah.
Should we know all the dates of which each one reigned?
No. You ought to know, Russ had the chronology pretty well in mind as to how the different reigns corresponded to what was going on in Palestine. With the events of how they correspond with not Nazi. That's wrong. Not with the events in Palestine, but with the events in the Testament in general. We go back, we go beyond Palestine. Then we talked about the Herods. I tried to draw some order out of the confusion that because the New Testament does not distinguish between the Herods, but if we had Herod Antipater, who rescued Julius Caesar, established the Herodian line, Herod the Great, who slaughtered the infants of Bethlehem, birth of Jesus. After the death of Herod, you recall that he divided up his kingdom between his three sons, Philip, and Tetrarch, Archelaus in Galilee, and Antipas in, sorry, Archelaus
in Judea,
Antipas in Galilee, but Archelaus was deposed by Augustus. Why?
Cruelty.
And was placed under the governor, who was responsible for the levy of Syria. And that's why Jesus was tried both before a governor, because he was in Judea and was arrested, and before Herod, Antipas, because he was from Galilee. And Antipas, while Judea was under the rule of governors during this period, Galilee was still under the king, Herod Antipas. Later on, that Agrippa the First was restored to be ruled over much of what his grandfather had, as Herod the Great. First, this was the Herod who beheaded James, whose death is described in Acts chapter 12. And then the next Herod was Agrippa the Second, who was a king in name only, because once again Judea had gone under governors, an honorary title. This was the Herod before whom Paul stood, who said he was almost persuaded. Agrippa the Second. I don't know, because it makes the name of the altar in the New Testament.
Which one again was the one that Christ appeared before?
Which one was it? Antipas. Why? Because he is the governor of Galilee. He appeared before Pilate because Judea was under governor. Very confusing if you don't know that, you know, from the outside source. You should be saying. Very confusing. Okay, any questions on the Herodian succession? We discussed, as you recall, Paul, his background from where? What kind of town?
Free City.
Free City and Educational Center. We discussed Antioch, which was the first city of the empire. We call that. Antioch was known for being a godly place, right? Wrong. It was a very wicked place. We call it their reputation for slander and epithet. Kind of connected this to the fact that Christians were first called a nickname there. The disciples were first called a nickname for Christian. The disciples were first called Christian. And I'll discuss that on our conclusion with my conclusion. There's not many grounds for that, because Christian does not appear to be a majority. It never appears to be a majority term. Christian never seems to be an insult. And there's nothing in the name itself that is particularly insulting. I'm not dependent if the Antiochans are going to really insult the Christians, they're going to have a better name than that. That's an insult, a better insult. Talked about Ephesus and the cult of Artemis or Diana. Always involved in that, show pictures of it. Talked about Ephesus and the center of emperor worship as well. Talked about Corinth and Isthmia, which is nearby, and Paul's use of metaphors, athletic metaphors, a possible and probable connection with the emphasis on athletics in the Corinthian Isthmian area. That's what we talked about. That's the only city that can be discussed in the main. Any questions concerning Paul? We've heard a lot of material. Something about Paul's training. Paul was trained as under Gamaliel, had a Hebrew training, no indication he had a good classical education. He did, but it showed in his writings. What does the word Paul mean?
Small.
Did any indication of scripture that were small?
Yeah.
What is an indication?
His appearance, it wasn't my impression.
Okay, it's not impressive in appearance, but I mean, what that meant, I'm not told, but it suggests the strong possibility that he was short. Small.
Is that correct?
Second. Now, we don't know what I don't want to give these lectures again. I don't know exactly what all you would like to go over. About Jewish Christianity and Gentile, very important discussion. Jewish Christianity versus Gentile Christianity. The difference was cultural or theological?
Cultural.
There's no difference in the doctrine they taught. There was a difference in the cultural expressions of their faith and the problem in the traditional council in Acts 15. The problem was that Jews had trouble recognizing that certain things are matters of faith, certain things are matters of opinion. We discussed the many implications of the destruction of the Jewish state, which began when false messiahs arose. Some of those were from Galilee, Titus, but down to Jerusalem. Silva, the Roman general, was responsible for the Battle of Masada, the siege of Masada. The implications we've got for the church, what are the implications for the church? Of the fall of Jerusalem. How did that affect the church? First of all, the church knew what was going to happen. Why? Prophecy of Jesus, and they escaped it. What was other than having a relationship with Jews?
Jews wouldn't forgive them for nothing.
Jews never forgave them. There was just antagonism and antipathy that exists from then on between Christians and Jews, which you saw all through the Middle Ages. Of course, basically, and anti-Semitic Jews. They didn't begin to hate each other.
Question about
Christians in the temple?
They are.
Do you support the temple?
Yes, I think so. They think they support the temple. Well, maybe they continue. I don't think they support the animal sacrifice. It doesn't mind a heart anymore.
What about like the ark and stuff?
Don't know. So you wouldn't have to get a tithe to the temple. Pay a temple tax. I think most Christians pay the temple tax than the Jewish Christians. Don't know anyone who's getting it. Yes, what was our discussion? What was our, the basics of our discussion in this encode?
Humicide theory?
Yeah, well, what was the source of this theory of the humicide?
No, there were two views or two aspects of the Messiah from the Old Testament.
Okay, there's an attempt to reconcile the picture of the Old Testament Messiah as Lord and ruler, also the picture of him as the son of his servant. And one of the ways to work that. Where is this reflected on Jewish writings?
Talmud and
Quran documents of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's still around today. One of them is very, very prominent today. Well, not to decide the two comings. And one is to be Redeemer, another next time to be Lord. And so it's very, very important concept. Well, as I said, I don't intend to get these lectures over again. Think of areas that you're going over your notes that you really have something you'd like to talk about more.
The course of ancient history and this tape.
I've asked you